Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the craziest 90 minutes on the internet and featured on VOC Nation, 5 o'clock p.m. on Friday afternoon, 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. This is Dr. John Stamey emanating from, that's the word tonight, I'm emanating from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the sun, fun, and COVID capital of the world, of course, but we don't talk about the COVID. Other people are talking about it, but we're not. Anyway, it's great to be here with pop culture stars. We got a great show lined up. It's going to be so much fun. You're going to go away either laughing or crying. Either way, you're going to enjoy it. So first of all, I want to introduce my hosts. First of all, our longest running co-host, in other words, the one that can stand us the most for the longest amount of time, is none other than author Dave Atwell. How are you, Dave?
Hey, I'm doing real good this evening. I've had to switch the venue a couple times over, thanks to Mother Nature, who can't decide whether she wants to rain on me or clear up. So it's been off and on. But today is a very special day for me because it was 15 years ago today that I actually gained a very special title of granddad. So my two oldest grandchildren, who are twins, turned 15 today. And they are total knockouts, total geniuses, and they make me a nervous wreck because of that. But, yeah, today's their birthday, big 15. I couldn't be prouder of them. And, yeah, granddad's a great title to hold. I dig it. It's I'd even rate it up better than dad to a certain extent. So, yeah, feeling pretty good.
Well, happy birthday,
the cool
girl.
The thing about being a
granddad
is great.
There's some honesty.
Because what you just load them up with Red Bull and Mountain Dew and M&Ms, and then you send them back home.
You dirty rascal, you. All right,
yeah,
next in line. Next in line, Todd Saxon, normally from Indianapolis, but for right now in beautiful, sunny Jacksonville, North Carolina. The home of everything beautiful and grand and lots of flowers. Todd, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing outstanding to supernatural, and I am ecstatic to be here, gentlemen and Granny Hulkster. I am just, this is the best place to be on Wednesday nights, be able to hang out. It is, it's my weekly decompression. I'm just saying. It's,
We're glad you can decompress with us. We are. And our newest member of our panel and crew from Indianapolis, Indiana, Tim Armstrong. Tim, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing awesome. I am always grateful to be here, humbled to be here, and still out on the porch. Not sure how many more weeks I'll be able to be out here because, you know, fall will be approaching soon, but I've got my cocktail in hand, and I'm ready to relax and have a great time for the next 90 minutes.
Well, that's good. We're glad to have you here. And now tonight, our guest, one of the best friends anybody could have, and I am anybody. So one of the best friends I could ever have. His name is Dr. Trey Donaway, and he is from Camden, South Carolina. He's a board-certified surgeon. He is truly one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I have to anyway, good evening, Trey. How are you doing?
Good, John. I see you're getting my checks on a regular basis, so you can promote me. That's wonderful
well,
to know
the,
that I'm
last
it's money
one
well
hasn't
spent.
Come yet, but... Okay. Well, I've got to tell everybody how we met because this is really one of my best stories ever. We were doing caricatures at some antique show in Camden. And I heard that they had some really good barbecue right down the road at a parking lot for historic Camden. And I was hungry, so I walked on down there. And on the way down there, I had been talking with a fellow named Carl, because he runs the Beaufort Pirate Invasion. And he told me that if I ever could find a cannon, and in fact, his name was Carl Cannon. Carl said that if I could find a cannon, he would bring some of his pirates down there and merry men and all that stuff and damsels in distress, and we could have us a little festival. I said, that sounds just great. So I happened to be walking by two men finally dressed in the most stylish Revolutionary War outfits you've ever seen. And they, and in between
the
two
which can easily be mistaken for a pirate outfits. That happens all the time. What, are you a pirate?
Here's
18th century.
Here's what really happened. You know, I looked in between them, there's a cannon, and I said, and then there was a sign down there that said, for rent. And I said, oh, yeah, if there's a cannon for rent, maybe we can get some of the pirates down here and damsels in distress. We'd have a little fun down here next to the river. It sounds like a good time to me. So I spoke to the gentleman on my left, a tall, very distinguished guy, and I said, I'd like to maybe rent your cannon. And he said, what? I said, well, you have a sign there that says cannon for rent. How does one go about renting your cannon? And then he looked at the other guy. He said, it sounded like something from Animal House. He said, what did he say? I said, and the third time, how do I rent your cannon? I know some people. I run festivals, and I know some pirate types. And they said if I would get a cannon, they might come down and bring themselves dressed up and some damsels in distress. We could have just a fine little festival. And the gentleman on the right, who hadn't said anything, started laughing a little bit. We started talking. And the one on the right, on my right, was Trey Nonaway. And so I told him a little bit that I had run some festivals and things like that, and that I was interested. This is a nice place, historic Camden, and maybe we could do some things here. You know, I'm just down there in Myrtle Beach. And he didn't miss a beat. This is the fastest promotion I've ever seen. He said, all right, well, that's great. You need to join Historic Camden. I'm going to take you right down there to the office, and you can pay $35 and join it, and then we'll talk. And that, I believe, is how it happened. And I went down there and joined. Oh, by the way, the gentleman who took my money, I happened to have a copy of my Lizard Man book with him, and he told me a Lizard Man story, and that got in the second edition of the Lizard Man book. So, it couldn't have been a better day. I met one of the very good friends I've got. I joined Historic Camden, and I got a Lizard Man story. That's more than most people can get in one day. Trey, tell us about yourself.
I looked at it as a great day to meet you, John. It was a lot of fun, and we still have not yet had the Pirate Fest. But, you know, when you rent a cannon, you just don't get the cannon. You get the people that know how to fire it, because not everybody can fire a cannon relatively safely.
Listen here, you brought me out there to Historic Camden. There were about five of you, and you guys were going to fire the cannon. You said, John, you need to hear it. And right before it, you said, put your hands over your ears, John. This is loud. I said, oh, sure. And so I stood there with my hands in my pockets, and I thought I was going deaf for 2 days. That's the loudest sound I ever heard, Ray. You were right.
Yeah, and that wasn't even a full charge. That was less than half a charge. By the time of the revolution, they were pretty loud, but by the time the Civil War rolled around, you could crack windows with that, because those were really big cannons. But cannons are an interesting pop culture, literally, pop. Boom culture, I guess it would be, more than a pop.
I don't know why when you said it, the whole pop thing, all I saw was a little coming out the end with the little flag that said bang.
Yeah, or pop. Yeah, exactly right. This does a little bit better. If you stuck a stick in it, the stick would end up flying down the field. So, they're loud.
I get it.
They're cannons.
Oh, my God, they are.
I want to do one more thing before we get too far into this. Dr. John, did you want to mention somebody
else?
Yes,
Todd. Pardon?
I don't think you mentioned Granny, John.
Oh my God, I didn't, because Granny, we already talked so much beforehand. One of our best friends, Granny Hulkster from Springdale, Arkansas, and we're so glad to have you, Granny. I am so sorry. You know we love you.
You're
fine,
Dr. John. I know you. You know what? It's perfectly fine, Dr. John. You know, no apology necessary. So it's okay.
Well,
I know you all.
You know what happens when guys start talking about cannons? It, you know,
that's an important, you know, that's an important thing, and that's an important conversation, and that's perfectly fine. I'm okay with everything. I just called in just to kind of listen because I really didn't have anything else better to do tonight. And I love this show, so, you know, I was on last week when Chaz Moretti was on, so I had to call back in again this week. So, you know, it's perfectly fine.
Granny, that's one of the best endorsements we ever had. I called in because I didn't have anything better to do.
Hey, I didn't, you know, I mean,
you got me.
I mean,
right,
I could be watching AEW, you know, but right now I'm watching Guy's Grocery Games on the Food Network, you know, but hey, you know, it's okay. So I enjoy listening to your all show. So
it's just crazy. We're going to have Chaz back in a couple of weeks. We got a couple of announcements with Chaz. So it's going to be grand. Anyway, let's see. So now, Dr. Trey Donaway, tell us a little bit about your story and how did you get interested and involved in this Revolutionary War reenactment craze? And I'd call it a craze because I tell you what, those people are madly in love with this stuff, aren't they?
Well, they love history so much they actually try to reenact it, to live it, to live as Revolutionary War soldiers at reenactments. And the camp followers are cooking, open fire cooking. It's all 18th century styled equipment, not much real 18th century because it's too expensive to put it to fire. But everything you encounter at these reenactments is living history. And it's a wonderful way for people to learn a little bit about our heritages and our past. And also it's just a great adventure for kids because it makes history come alive for them. And that makes it just so much more interesting. You know, I moved to Camden, South Carolina, when I was looking for a surgical place to practice. And when we moved to Camden, I found out it was the oldest inland town in South Carolina. So depending on your dates, about 1731 is when it was first settled, but that was sparse. And in the late 18th century, it was a hotbed of revolutionary activity, and that's something most people don't know about South Carolina, talking about pop culture, and their reasons, and the reason why they don't know is because of the Civil War. Let me explain. If you look at in the Revolutionary War, a fourth of all casualties were suffered in the entire war in South Carolina in the last year or so of the war. There were more battles and skirmishes fought in South Carolina than any other state in the Union. Well, you say, well, what about Lexington and Concord? Well, I think it's because the people in the North had the better press agents. And then when the Civil War came, any patriotic reference to the South was stripped away. And history books stripped away the patriotism of the South, and the whole reason we don't speak with a British accent is because of the Southern campaigns of the Revolutionary War, which were fought at the end of the Revolution. There was a stalemate in the northern part of the nation with the British and the Patriots, and they moved the war south to gain as much territory as possible in order to get a better negotiating position, assuming there would be a settlement to the war. Well, it didn't work out that way. And everyone thinks at the end of the war, Yorktown was at the end of the war, and that happened in October, but it wasn't until December the next year that the troops actually leave South Carolina. So a lot of warfare went on after Yorktown, which everyone figured, well, after Yorktown, George Washington sprang from a rock and became president, and the British went away, but it took them over a year to finally go away, and that was all because of South Carolina. So very historic town, and little did I know, when I moved here, about all of that history, and as I learned it, I became much more interested in our local history, and it led me to develop a long-term relationship with Historic Camden. I was chairman of the Historic Camden Foundation, but a few months ago, we participated and founded a new 501c3, although we're still waiting for that designation. It's COVID, of course. The IRS pretty much had to shutter a lot of their offices, and when we get that 501c3 status, it should be in November, we've been told. but we are conducting the annual Revolutionary War Field Days. It's the 50th anniversary for this huge group of reenactors. It's the fourth largest in the United States, and we are going to have it at a new location this year, and it is independent of Historic Camden, and it is by the organization has the clever name of Revolutionary War Field Days. We figured, why not? It's worked for 50 years. It'll work for us this year. And that's my path to history and reenacting.
I like it. Now, I'm just curious, when they do the reenactments, are you playing any, are you bringing any of your doctor role, if you are, if you will? Are you running the MASH unit of the reenactment?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Most reenactors, and honestly, I am not a reenactor, more a demonstrator. The real hardcore reenactors are called the progressive reenactors. And the progressives, they act like they are in the 18th century. I mean, they only bring the food in on their backs. They sleep on the ground. It's pretty rough going, and it's as a 18th century soldier would have been. And then they have other reenactors who might have a camp with a cot or a little bit more comfortable, all 18th century still. And then you have other type of people like me who would spend the night in a hotel and get dressed in the air conditioning and then go out into the heat and do the reenacting business. But I'm more of a demonstrator. So I do a little bit of 18th century medicine demonstrations, but I also portray someone who was in the militia in South Carolina, and I'm on a cannon crew, and I do a couple of other things in the 18th century styles. So there's a wide range of people that are really hardcore, and people that are serious, and people that just enjoy demonstrating 18th century crafts and handicrafts and cooking demonstrations, skinning a deer, all these 18th century things that people forget about. And again, when you get to see this in actuality, I'm telling you, it's the most fascinating thing you've ever seen, because it's the way things were done over 200 years ago.
You mentioned some of the food and demonstrations. Was hardtack one of the main staples, or was that more around the Civil War era?
Hardtack was used in the 18th century. It certainly was. And it's interesting to read some of the – the nice thing about hardtack, too, is it still can be edible, even from the Civil War, because it's made out of a little bit of salt, flour, and water, and it's hard as a rock. So there was hardtack in the 18th century. But there's also something called pemmican. When we launched our 501c3, we had a gathering and a party, as much as COVID would allow, and we made pemmican, which is a dried, lean meat. I used London broil and dried blueberries. You can use any kind of berries, but I had blueberries available that I could dry. And then you mix that with some suet or lard, and it was the original energy bar, and it's thousands of years old because it was used in North America as an energy bar. It's got the protein, it's got the fat, and it's got the carbohydrate, and it actually tastes very good, remarkably good. So that in addition to hardtack was some of the staples where somebody could travel, and it keeps forever. So
right.
That's some of the food. But, I mean, people will say, well, what do they eat in the 18th century? And the answer is things like chicken and rice and bread and pretty much the stuff we eat today. It was just prepared a little bit differently. Well, it was prepared a lot differently and a lot more wild game.
First generation MREs right there.
That's what it was. That's exactly right. Like a cliff bar. Just highly concentrated protein, carbohydrate, and fat.
Well, that was nice that you actually added the fruit to it because, I mean, let's face it, scurvy was the thing back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then, of course, on naval life, that was a real big deal, but the British finally figured that out, hence the limeys from eating lime juice, from consuming the lime juice. But the... you know, it really has sparked an interest. I've always been interested in historic fiction, and this really is fun to actually see it happening. You can read about it. Oh, what's the book? Outlander, the book about Jamie Fraser and his adventures in 18th century America. Well, you can actually see the things that Jamie Fraser in reality would have seen had he been a real person back in the 18th century. And, of course, shooting a cannon, that's all part of the fun, too.
Well, I'll tell you, as somebody that was both a 20th, end of 20th and early 21st century military member, the whole sleeping on the ground is still a thing for our military.
It absolutely is. My dad was in the Navy, and I said, "Dad, why did you go into the Navy?" He said, "Because I always have a bed at night." He almost always did. But I tell you, if you're infantry, army, or the Marines, you're not guaranteed a bed. Air Force gets a little bit easier than Air Force and the Marines too. But you know, sleeping on the ground is still a thing. It sure is.
Absolutely is. And I had to laugh. You were talking about the Navy and stuff. Did your dad happen to serve on subs?
No, he was a line officer on carriers and destroyers.
Oh, okay. And I was just bringing up subs because people, it's kind of one of the things that the inter-service rivalries that we would give them trash for about sharing a bunk. But the on the subs, they have to, especially some of the earlier ones, I don't know if that's necessarily current with some of the newer models, but they would have to hot rack or hot bunk. There was only so much room on one of those things. And so when this guy's shift started, he got up, got out of that rack, and that other guy, when his shift ended, he came over and got into that rack.
That's what I understand. And in some instances, I understand if it was really crowded, you could have three guys sharing a bed, taking different shifts to sleep.
Yep.
That would be really
kind
now,
of
were you in submarines?
No, just had to learn about them. I'm a retired Marine.
Well, when I was in my surgical residency in Mobile, Alabama, the USS Alabama, newly commissioned, was on its way from Groton, I think, to the West Coast. And it stopped in Mobile, Alabama. And it was a big fanfare. And the TV and radio said, don't go down there because only friends and family and it's only VIPs and you can't get admission to the submarine. And my wife was at we're running an antique shop, and she had some sailors come in and they were hitting on her. And she was polite to them, and they invited her onto the submarine. And she said, well, I thought it was only for friends and family and stuff. And they said, well, you can be our family. And she said, well, that's very nice. I'd love to do that. And would you mind if I brought my husband with me? They were a little crestfallen, but I did get a tour of that submarine. It was a boomer, so it was a missile boat, and it was way cool, and the ship's position was in. So I introduced myself when I said, this is a doctor, here's another doctor, and I introduced myself, and we started talking, and I said, and what kind of physician, do you have a specialty? And he goes, yes, I'm an OBGYN. He said, you're an OBGYN on a submarine? And he said, well, the Navy doesn't look at it that way. They say, I'm a doctor. Yes, I'm a doctor. Well, then you can be a doctor on our submarine. It doesn't matter that there are no women on the submarine. You can still be a doctor. So, again, almost hot racking. Still, necessity calls for certain things to be done in the Navy, and that was an example of it.
That's awesome. Now, I want to bring that up since you were talking doctor to doctor and you're out there and you do some old 18th century medicine. I balled your bio a little bit, and I see that you're a general surgeon. So you didn't treat any of the enlisted guys. You just treated the generals?
Only the generals. No, treated the whole gamut. Just like the general has to take care of all of his enlisted as well as the officers, same thing for general surgeons.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you were a private physician, I figured you'd be taking care of the privates. I'm just saying. For those that are in the military, it's an old joke. They would call it a general cleanup in a certain area, basically the barracks where everybody lived. The general never showed up. But if you go in the general's building, there's a private bathroom. And let me tell you, there wasn't a private allowed in it. I'm just saying, there was a lot of things that were confusing in the military. It was for the general only. There was a private bathroom. Just saying.
Okay, Todd.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Very much.
There could have been more. I could have done the Bigfoot joke. Hey, Bigfoot gets confused with Sasquatch, yet he never gets angry.
I know. I didn't. You noticed you sent me that on Facebook earlier this week, and I never replied.
I sent it on. You know the sad thing, Dr. John, is Dave actually laughed at it.
Dave never laughed at anything.
Hey, I wanted to go back to the Battle of Camden real quick and ask. This kind of stuff really intrigues me. I used to be a big Civil War buff, and I loved. At one point in time when I was a kid, I could have told you the entire battle plan and what took place every single day of Gettysburg, and I've even been there, and I loved it. I had a blast. But I did a little bit of this up, too, myself. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a little bit of the Battle of Camden that was actually portrayed in the movie The Patriot. It didn't look like there might have been much of it, just kind of a short bloodbath, but I thought that was kind of interesting. But one of the questions I had for you is when you're doing these reenactments, which, or maybe it's both of them, which of the battles do you actually reenact? Because if I'm not mistaken, there was, you know, the bigger bloodbath that was on August 16th. But then there was another one, like you were mentioning, where technically they say the British did win, but it ended up leading to them retreating. So it was more of a significant battle there to begin. So Popkirk Hill. So, and I know there was a jump there in several months, but I didn't know if maybe when those are being reenacted, if both of those battles are portrayed, or if there's if it's any of them, maybe it's just a general skirmish.
From what I've seen, this is what happens: is that, you know, reenactors usually belong to a unit. So you can have the 2nd South Carolina, and it was represented Continental soldiers during the Revolution, mainly from the Low Country, and it would consist then of Continental soldiers that were made Continental soldiers from militia. So that's a unit. So the reenactors still have units. So we've got all sorts of different units that are coming. For this reenactment, I mean, we've got this is the fourth largest reenactment in the country, so it's big, and we already have commitments from military units that have been from Wisconsin, Florida, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, of course, North, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, close by. So you really have a wide variety of people, and you know, they're the Crown Forces, so those are going to be your British. And then the Patriot Forces, which would be, you know, you got to be careful, too, when you talk about the culture of the Revolution. You can't say the Americans were here or the Americans were there, because most of the British forces were, Native American, not Native American, but Americans who were in this country, but they were just loyal to the crown. This was the first Civil War, especially in South Carolina. But, you know, when the reenactors are – when they gather, and it depends on who shows up and who doesn't, a lot of times they'll have the commanders will get together, and they kind of have playbooks. And they'll say, well, there was a cavalry group in this one. We'd have to have cavalry for this. Well, the cavalry may or may not have shown up. So if the cavalry didn't show up, they're not going to do a battle that was dependent on the cavalry. So there's a little bit of flexibility, but when they actually lay the battles out, they try to keep true to form as much as you can as a demonstration. So, you can have a Battle of Camden, but the thing about the demonstrators and the reenactors is that the Patriots would be very, very discouraged if they lost both battles. on Saturday and then again on Sunday. So they usually pick one where the British can win and one where the Patriots win, so that both sides can win one of the battles.
Which
but they will portray battles as accurately as they can with the representative troops that they have. So your cavalry unit, you know, on a lean year, you just might have two horses, which represents the cavalry, and sometimes you have six, eight, ten horses, which let me tell you, you can see how terrifying it would have been to have somebody coming at you at a full gallop on a horse, swinging a saber that was razor sharp, and with the force it would strike you, it would just take off an arm, hack off half of your head, just completely demoralize an enemy troop that's sustaining a cavalry attack. You got to think that a muzzle-loading musket, it's not like it's rapid fire, and by the time you get close enough to have any accuracy of your shot, which in a muzzle-loader is poor with a musket, you'd have one shot, and then the cavalry would be on you before you could reload. So it was truly a terrifying thing. And when you can see those horses with guys that have, I mean, this is their hobby. So this is what they train to do. It really makes you understand the power of 18th century horsemen and cavalry.
Right.
Wow. Now, this is Dr. John. I've got to break in for just 1 minute and do a station break and say thank you very much to the management of VOC Nation for having us on their network on Friday afternoon at 5 p.m., Brady Hicks. And believe it or not, VOC Nation is, I believe right now, the top wrestling podcast network in the United States, and we're very proud to be that. We've been part of VOC Nation, my goodness, 3.5 years. And on Monday nights, if you can't get enough of this, you can tune into Scarycast. We've been on VOC Nation for about 1.5 years now. So thanks again to Brady Hicks and all of his great personalities and everything. And we'll get back right now to Dr. Trey Donaway and pop culture stars. Pop goes the cannon.
Pop goes the cannon.
Dr. Dunaway, I want to throw something out there. Earlier you were speaking on education and what's taught and what's not. And when I was a child growing up in the 70s, my dad, who was in the Marine Corps, he was on recruiting duty in Chicago in the middle 70s. And everything that was taught was, first off, everything's Abe Lincoln. They tell you about Abe Lincoln, then they tell you about Jesus Christ. Abe Lincoln was like, you know, you talk about math and somehow it had a factor to do with Abe Lincoln. Nevertheless, when they were teaching the Revolution, they never spoke of anything further south than Maryland. So everything that I had learned about the Revolution was everything Philadelphia, you know, Washington, D.C., Washington himself, you know, Benedict Arnold and all that, everything that was Ticonderoga, all that kind of stuff that was happening up north. So when I moved to Parris Island, South Carolina, which was one hell of a culture shock, you go from tall buildings to a swamp, and here I am, an 8-year-old kid, you know, just totally shot full of holes. I didn't know whether to, you know, I can remember coming home from school just a total basket case, you know, because I couldn't understand the southern dialect. The school was totally different than what I was going to and everything. And they started to, it was like a whole different ball game. And they were teaching the history, but they were teaching, you know, they started talking about the American Revolution, and me as a 9-year-old kid, I'm thinking, okay, I've got this. And they start speaking on people I've never heard of. And, you know, it made it tough. But then I also found out that there's such a rich, especially in South Carolina. And I had done this big project, and I'm trying to remember, and granted, we got to think it's 40-some-odd years ago, so my memory's doing good to go back 40 minutes, much less 40 years, thanks to my alcohol consumption over those years. But nevertheless, Francis Marion, who was known as the Swamp Fox, and one of his big contribution, which I found very interesting, is that when Horatio Gates was leading the colonists, he was getting shot to pieces because what he was trying to do was stand toe-to-toe with a better-armed British military along with the Tories, you know, South Carolina. And when he was replaced by Green, that was when Francis Marion started working into it. And he was the gentleman who, for if I'm remembering correctly, he was the one who started the guerrilla warfare, so to speak, climbing in the trees, attacking caravans in the woods, that kind of stuff. And, you know, a lot of the success was contributed to those tactics. So, you know, with all that being said, it's kind of amazing what a rich history and interesting history that South Carolina has towards the Revolution. But you made a statement earlier, they don't get the credit that they do, and for how much was sacrificed in the state over the years, you know, of the Revolution. So, yeah, I thought Francis.
Well, you're right.
Very interesting guy.
You're right. In 1861, when the Civil War started, that's when the patriotism was stripped away. And you can thank George Bancroft. He was the Secretary of the Navy in the 19th century, but he was a Harvard professor who basically was one of the authors of the history book for schools. So your school book very much was written by George Bancroft or his proteges. And what they did is when you look at the Bancroft history before the Civil War, it's got a fair amount of references to the war in the South, but after the Civil War, not so much. But people do know and respect the Swamp Fox, Francis Marion. Of course, he did have his own TV show. That always helps the reputation of a general. But he did do the hit and run business. He would hit and then disappear into the woods. Drove the British crazy. And even when Green took over, when Horatio Gates came down to stand against Cornwallis at the Battle of Camden, you know, his best troops, well, Cornwallis's best troops were up against the North Carolina militia, and when the even though the British were outnumbered 2-1 from the Patriot forces to the British forces, when the superior firepower of the crack, battle-hardened, battle-trained British troops ran up against the North Carolina militia, who were basically farmers a couple of weeks before, the North Carolina militia folded and ran, and then the British did an end run on the on Gates's left flank, and that was the battle. It was over in an hour. It was the worst defeat of an American field army up until World War II. So it was huge battle loss. But people don't know about that.
They were also sick, weren't they? I think the
troops
were also
the story
sick.
Goes is they were eating green corn and molasses, and it didn't do well with the soldiers. But the real difference is that Cornwallis's troops were highly trained, highly disciplined, and the half of the Patriot Army was militia. But then again, that did give rise to why North Carolina has their license plate tag.
Remind us what that is. I'm from there, and I forgot. Oh, First in Flight.
Sure, you know, John. What is that?
Yeah, First in Flight.
Absolutely. Once it started getting hairy, the North Carolina militia took off. Now North Carolina today would say, well, of course, that's because it was the Wright brothers. But we know better. From 1780, that's what the whole First in Flight business was all about, because they just took off. But because of George Bancroft, it bankrupted the South for patriotism, and it gave rise to the belief that all the war was fought in the North, and it absolutely was not. And this year is the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the war in the South, and the state of South Carolina is very much invested in bringing the Liberty Trail to life, which is where you can follow in the footsteps of the different battles and the different troop movements. So when Gates was defeated and he went back north, some say he fled in the face of this collapse. I think he was just trying to get to North Carolina to get up into the Charlotte area and get a big block of rooms reserved at the Motel 6 for the troops that were heading back north. But when Greene took over, Greene ran the British ragged, literally ran them ragged. He had a lighter, more maneuverable force, a smaller force, and he would hit and run. And Cornwallis, with a much more cumbersome army, would chase him all over the Southeast and up into North Carolina. And then eventually he ended up in Yorktown, and then you know the story from there, or at least where everyone thinks the war ended. But the war really kept going in South Carolina for a good another year before they finally were liberated from the British in Charleston. But you're right. When you come to the South, you're going to hear that, and that's what the 250th anniversary of the Southern campaigns in South Carolina is all about, starting in this year, to educate people about the way South Carolina was in the war.
You know, and there's a lot going on with that, with some of the stuff you guys have touched on. One of the things I'm going to talk about is ballistics of the time here. And so if somebody will bring us back to that, that'd be awesome. But I'd like to throw out to one of our listeners that, no, I was not a neighbor of General Washington. Thank you. Whether I want to call you Dismay or Mayhem, for our listener that's out there, since they're sending messages. But seriously, now, let me throw this out. One of the first for the United States Marine Corps, one of our first amphibious movements is, and people forget how much land is covered, we actually did a raid off the coast of Florida onto an island to steal. Basically, it was straight up a pirate move. We jumped in there to grab munitions and all the, you know, all the stuff that went with it. The you know, the powder, the weapons and stuff like that. So that was one of those moves. You take supplies away from them.
Todd, you guys sounded like the acquisitions committee of my fraternity now. I thought everybody was
you know, but seriously, you were talking about how the armies were run ragged, trade the you know, much of the military concepts and movements, formations and all that, while the weaponry had changed, they were still heavily influenced by the Roman legions' box formations.
Yes. The cavalry units would come up to when you box your infantry. That was the only effective way to beat a cavalry troop. And if you didn't have time to do that, you're going to get overrun, as happened in Lancaster County, just north of the Battle of Hanging Rock, Buford's massacre. And that was what happens when you let cavalry officers run wild on ground troops, and that's where Bloody Tarleton got his nickname from, that Buford's massacre.
It's insane that something, and part of the reason that I wanted to mention how the formations went that far back to the Roman frickin' legions, we're talking at the zero calendar number for the Roman legions. That stuff was still going on, you know, nearly 1,800 years later, being heavily influenced by that. The British forces, there were for those that don't realize it, there were actually rifled weapons at the time. And Trey had touched a little bit earlier about the reloading and the rate of fire. So the rifled weapons, the early ones, and those that don't get it, just basically it was the grooves inset within on the inside of the barrel to put a spin on the round going downrange. And then we even learned to change the shape of the round to increase accuracy. The revolutionary forces, the crown was still using, what was it, the Brown Bess? Is that right?
The Brown Bess was the standard long arm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think there's a problem when people look back into time, they tend to think of the 18th century as quaint. It wasn't quaint. They were using the technology that was available for them at the time, and their formations, you know, you say, well, who in their right mind would stand up in a line and shoot at another line of soldiers? Well, that's what the technology demanded. You know, a musket ball is like throwing a marble through a pipe, and it'll bang from one side of the pipe to the other, and when it actually exits the barrel, just depends on where its last bounce was. It's highly inaccurate, and the accuracy, you know, if you got to 50 yards, you were then beginning to get accurate, but you really weren't accurate until people were closer. So they would do mass fire. They threw as much lead downrange as possible, and they would hit people. But that's the technology that was driving their troop formations. It absolutely was.
Yeah, it was accuracy by volume. Now these were there were a couple things on it I wanted to do. The one that like say in training and practice, just for the record, those that don't realize it, the folks that were wired, they could be pushing 4 rounds a minute with a musket. That is insanely rapid rate of fire for the time.
Yep.
Now, mind you, that is perfect conditions, and that never really happens once you're facing the enemy. But it was accuracy by volume. And they're talking about, and you were talking a 75 caliber round. Those that don't get it, you know, you hear a lot of different things for today's weaponry. Oh, somebody's got a 9mm. Think about it. It's pretty obvious. That's based on a metric measurement, 9mm. The caliber is based on an inch. So you're talking a 3/4 inch round. But not everybody had perfect molds back in the day for their stuff. And they're pretty much putting together their own extra ammo, stuff like that. They're talking with a 46-inch barrel on Brown Bess, 75 caliber round, and they knew, you know, they had made a little bit of movement with powder, had gotten a little better. They were hoping to hit a 100-foot target at 70 yards. 1 in 5 could hit it. 100-foot target. So you're talking about just trying to hit the other guy's line at 70 yards.
Yeah, the Battle of Camden started off on the Great Wagon Road. Cornwallis was coming north, and the Patriots, led by Gates, were going south. And the Patriots didn't get as far as they wanted to. Both armies were doing night marches, and they banged into each other at about 2 in the morning. And they pulled back after a little skirmishing. They pulled back. They set up their artillery. And the morning opened up with arterial barrages. And these are multiple cannons on both sides. And at the time, you used a small cannon. You used what's commonly called the grasshopper because of the way the handles looked, that you could carry this. And it was light enough to make it through the backcountry of the Carolinas. So it wasn't a real strong, big cannon. It was a 3-pound cannon, and they started off with artillery barrages. And what was interesting about the artillery barrage, of course, was it was still dark, it was cloudy, and they couldn't see properly. because of all the smoke it generated. And they have never found a cannonball on a cannon battlefield. And that's primarily because they were using grape shot, which is like 1-inch diameter balls, and canister, which is the musket balls just put in a cannon. And so it's like shooting shotguns at each other down the road. But again, it's all technology driven.
Yeah, that's wow. You know, even reading up on pirates and everything, I had done a little study on that when I was thinking about running a, writing a novel with some pirate era stuff. The different type of artillery that they used, you know, depending on the ships they were fighting and how they, if they had, whether they wanted to take down a ship that was faster than theirs, larger than theirs, better, had more firepower. And they had everything from, they would put chains in there. They would actually stuff chains and shoot those off. And the whole idea behind those was not to sink the ship. The whole idea was to tear the masting all apart. So then that way the ship was a sitting duck. They used to even take trash and stuff it in the cannons and shoot it. And I've always found it amazing. You know, you were talking about the amount of noise and rumble that these cannons make. To be on a wooden ship, and if you've ever been on a wooden-hulled ship, I'm here to tell you, there ain't but one thing that goes through my mind. I've been on a wooden-hulled ship 3 times, and every time I've been on them, all I've wanted to do is get the hell off of them.
There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of creaking and movement. Yeah.
Yeah. And from the minute you step on it, I don't care if you're in 2 foot of water, you feel like you're going to go down on the thing. And the thought of having those cannons booming, the amount of nerve, for these guys on the battlefield and all these pirate ships and everything, the amount of nerve and resolve these guys had to have back in those days is just unmeasurable. Just the noise alone. They talk about shell shock now. Could you imagine just being on the battlefield and having nowhere to go? And all you're hearing is these musket rounds.
Unless you're from North Carolina, and then you know you can go north.
And remember, it's not like they had smokeless powder.
No. Yeah. And that was the problem at the Battle of Camden because, you had if you have a temperature inversion, that smoke doesn't go away. So it got so cloudy that it was truly the fog of war. And one guy at a gun emplacement, his job was to point to where he saw the flash and hold his finger pointing at where the flash was. And that's where this cannon crew would direct the fire to go for the flash. Because if the cannon are being moved, and a 3-pounder can easily be moved by 4 guys, I mean, no problem. 4-pounder, a 3-pounder or a 4-pounder with 4 guys. So they would move it around, but his job was just to point at the flash so they'd know where to shoot because it was just completely fogged out from the smoke. Have you ever read any of Patrick O'Brien's books?
No, I haven't.
Patrick O'Brien wrote a series of 20, maybe 23 books. And it's all about 18th and early 19th century seafaring, Captain Jack Aubrey, Master and Commander, the movie.
Oh, yep.
You remember that one. Well, that was his first book in that series. So this guy goes all sorts of different adventures in the British Navy. But that really paints a good battle of the different type of armaments, how the French often would try to dismast the English ships because they wanted to recover the ships. They got prize money for that. And if there was things to be sold, that's how they got extra pay. So the French were more interested in dismasting. Well, on the other hand, timing your shot on the roll, if you're going to shoot below the waterline, then you're more likely to sink another ship. But the technology of the 18th century is not quaint. It was highly technical for the technology that they had available. And again, like I said, that's a misconception. The director of our cannon crew is Colonel Tom Oblak. And Tom was a U.S. Army. He ran mortar units.
And so it's natural that he would be attracted to the grasshopper cannon because it was the precursor to the mortar. It was an anti-personnel weapon. And, you know, the technology that they have, and if you applied it right and you knew what you were doing, you could be pretty accurate with those cannons at great distances. And really the science behind it was all figured out for battle. And, of course, so much of our progress is, unfortunately, through military prowess to defeat an enemy. I mean, look at the atomic weapons. That all came out because of warfare. But when you look at all the spinoffs of the science, unfortunately, battles are a great fertile ground for creativity for military and civilian use eventually.
Well, and much of it for medical use, too. The part of the conversation made me want to steer to, you know, go back to Constantinople. There was cannon used back then. And the way those have changed over the decades. But the medical things that have come in, let's face it, war helped with antibiotics.
And IV fluid resuscitation, you know, it really with moving wounded out of the field. The advent of the helicopter started in Korea, where you could rapidly evacuate somebody during that golden hour after trauma. And then with Vietnam also to rapidly extract troops to preserve the injured. A lot of things do spin off of the military in the medical field that have helped. Absolutely.
The medevacs are pretty much standard even in not large cities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it all started back in the day. It's just some of those things. I like it. We're kind of doing a little bit of a deeper dive into some of the stuff and some of the tangents that come on with it. It's just so much going on when you're talking this. I think it's been pretty cool because we've been able to cover, it started with your whole project here with the Revolutionary War days, We've gone all the way back to the Roman legions.
That's part of what we've done. This organization, yes, we on November 7th and 8th in Camden, South Carolina, is this huge reenactment. And you're welcome to go visit RevWarFieldDays.com. That's the website, all run together, RevWarFieldDays.com. And you can visit that website, and you can visit us on Facebook if you search under Rev War Field Days. And do visit and like us. That's always good for social media. But that's part of this organization's plan because it generates revenue. It's an annual event. It does generate revenue. But really the other arm of this is the educational opportunities to educate children, not just about how things were done in colonial and revolutionary era United States, but also to understand the founding of our country, the documents that it put together. Most people think of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence as old and dusty, but when you actually get to understand what it was about, what it refers to, the passages of the perceived and real offenses of the King of England, personalized to the King of England and the Declaration of Independence, that was groundbreaking stuff. And to create a nation from scratch, it was the American experiment, and that American experiment is still going on. But when we'd have tour groups come, a lot of times the date 1776 meant nothing to children. Now, I'm not just talking about the fourth graders who would come, but high school students. It would just mean nothing to them. And the founding of our nation and the principles upon which it's founded, which it's still operating on, that's something that should be educated. And the children and youth should understand where they came from. That's important, perhaps even more important than the actual battle reenactments. But the battle reenactments is where you get to shoot the cannon, so it's a lot more fun.
Well, Trey, I've got to stop us for 30 seconds and say thank you to the VOC Nation for having us. And we'll be here with this very broadcast on Friday night, 5 p.m., VOCNation.com. And it's great having you on here. We've got our full raft of people. We've got Todd Saxon. We've got Dave Atwell. We've got Tim Armstrong. We've got Granny Hulkster, our special and lovely guest. And I guess I will end my station break with probably one of the most unpopular statements I will ever make. But I highly doubt that the state of Oregon ever taught 1776.
That's why they are the way they are. Enough said.
And I know, and that may be the most unpopular thing I'll ever say, and I thoroughly believe it. All right, back to the program. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I just, you know, y'all were talking pirates earlier and stuff. I was just thinking of a funny story. I know this happened years ago, years before Granny Hulkster was ever thought of, but because my son, he was probably 7 or 8 years old, and we lived over at Holiday Island over by Eureka Springs in Arkansas. So we were just about an hour or so from Branson. And we went over to Branson one time, and we rode this, it was called the Sammy Lane. And they had this evil-looking pirate try to attack the ship. And they would pick somebody to help the captain and guard the gold. So my son and I, we got to guard the gold, but he also got to help the captain. So when it came time for, you know, the pirate came out, you know, on his boat to try to rob the gold from, I had to protect the gold. My son and I had to protect the gold. And that pirate was trying his best to get that gold from us, and we weren't going to let him have it. So my son, he got to, like, shoot the gun or the cannon or whatever it was, you know, to attack the pirate. That pirate guy, he lost his footing on his boat, and he almost fell into Table Rock Lake.
Granny and her family.
Well, you know, but I mean, like I said, that was way before Granny was ever thought of, guys. I mean, you know, I was just, you know, me. I mean, I was like, I wasn't even Granny Hulkster way back then, you know. But the pirate guy lost his footing and he almost fell into the lake. And when we got back to the dock thing. The guy that played the pirate, he had to come up and thank me and my son for doing such a good job protecting the gold and keeping him from robbing the gold from the boat.
Only Granny. That's great. That is wonderful.
Well, you were talking about pirates, and I thought, you were talking about battlefields. Well, here in Arkansas, we've got a couple of places, Prairie Grove, Arkansas, and Pea Ridge. They've got battlefield parks in both of those places. Now, I don't know about Prairie Grove, but I know Pea Ridge at one time was doing reenactments of, you know, the battles and stuff like that. But I don't think that they've been doing them, you know, for a while because of COVID and stuff. But I know at one time when I first moved to Arkansas, they used to be really big in doing the reenactments.
A lot of Civil War reenactments in Arkansas. And the fact of the matter is that the Civil War has fallen out of favor. A variety of reasons, and a lot of Civil War reenactors are now flipping over to Revolutionary War reenactment. It's the same same style of hobby, but it's I guess unless you're British, it's more politically correct. But Arkansas had a lot of Civil War activities, and that's what's reflected in it. You know, when we talk about reenacting. And this is invariable. We've fallen into the same trap guys always do, because it's all about the bang. It's all about the explosions and cannons and muskets and riflery. And that's what it is, because guys just seem to be attracted to that. But the other half of that is the living history part of it, where it talks about camp life and how people baked bread in the 18th century. This year we're having a dessert contest. So the camp followers, the distaff is what that's called, and these would be wives, girlfriends, and friendly women in some troops. So, you know, we have cooking demonstrations and a dessert contest, and all of the food that's prepared is prepared over an open fire. We've even got people that'll bring in brick ovens and show how baking is done. And it really is quite a production. Spinning, yarn, weaving, all of these handicrafts, pottery, all these handicrafts that were used in the 18th century. We've even got an 18th century preacher who will preach on Sundays, but on Saturday you'll see him as a resurrectionist. You recall the resurrectionists?
No,
in the
18th
century, physicians needed anatomic specimens so they could learn human anatomy.
Yeah.
So what the resurrectionists would do is they would find recently dead, dig them up, and sell them to medical men. So we've got one fellow that portrays a resurrectionist on Saturday, and he's a preacher on Sunday. So that all works out very neatly. But there's a whole variety of coopers and wood craftsmen, deer skinners, people that work with horns, horn instruments, kitchenware, pottery. It's just because it is all the home crafted things that were in the 18th century. And then you have a whole another dimension where if you just want unique Christmas gifts, well, all you got to do is just go to reenactment, and you're going to see handcrafted stuff that would have fit right into the 18th century made by craftsmen today. So it's a wonderful shopping opportunity. So when you come to a reenactment, it's more than just the bang. A lot of times I've got a good friend who's also on our board, Beth Webb. She and her husband, Jimmy, will bake fish in front of a fire. And this is plank cooking. You take a plank, you bury it into the ground, so it's slightly at an angle. You tie whole fish with cord onto the plank, and then you just park that in front of your fire. And in about 2 hours, you've got a wonderfully baked fish. And people will watch that, and they'll say, oh, this is great, and they'll go out to the battle, they'll see the battle, and then they'll come back because they want to see how the fish is doing too. So the camp life and the reenactment of living history of the 18th century is also a big draw for people. So it's not all just about firearms and the bang, although, frankly, as a guy, we really do like that part.
The uniform cool that you touched on that again, Dr. John. I'm going to run with this one. That was part of the logistics that wasn't built into the military at the time that was still required by the military. It's kind of they would go back and they would say, hey, we had 500 service members that were going back and they were doing the battle on this stuff. But they had no idea what kind of logistic train was going on with that, very much like the 300 Spartans weren't just 300 cats there. There was a hell of a lot more than 300 cats involved in defending that pass at Thermopylae.
Yeah, when you look at where the troops spent the night, the Patriot troops spent the night up on the Great Wagon Road, that baggage train ran all the way to where they were camping by the time the battle first commenced, the skirmish at night. And this is a little skinny road. It was one of the biggest roads in the backcountry of South Carolina, but by today's standards, it would be a dirt trail. And it's hard to turn those wagons around. And so what happened at the Battle of Camden was after the military part was over, the British raided that baggage train. So all of this stuff, supplies, ammunition, all of this stuff was rolled over to the British. So, again, that's what Francis Marion did. He would attempt to interrupt British supplies and try to take them for their own. You know, Francis Marion was basically dismissed from the Battle of Camden, primarily, I think, because he kind of looked like rabble to a fine general like General Gates. But it was the militia, after the defeat of the Continentals in South Carolina, it was the militia that held it together long enough until General Greene could come down. And then he realized the importance of the militia in South Carolina, and he used those effectively as the British chased them around, and they just wore the British out by having them chase them around South Carolina and North Carolina. So interesting stuff. Right here in Camden, South Carolina, oldest inland town in South Carolina.
I think it's still a valid tactic in interrupting logistics today.
Yes,
you bring a great point, though, about, you know, you mentioned the kids and keeping them engaged. And I think that was one of the things for me, you know, going back, I hated history. It was like the worst. I dreaded going to any kind of a history class. I thought, what do I need this for growing up? I don't need history. And one of the things that kind of kept me in the game was when, you know, we started talking about things like Gettysburg and different attacks, and that's what drew me in, and I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. But then it just, you kind of go off from there, and you're like, okay, well, what led to this? Well, why did they all come here? Well, what was the start of it? And that keeps you engaged, and, you know, that's more of Civil War talk, obviously, but the same thing with Revolutionary War. And like you said, you know, it leads to teaching kids, you know, what led to that? Why did we become the country that we are today? You know, and I think that's very key.
Well, that's absolutely correct. When you look at history, when I was in school, I thought of history as you had to memorize a lot of dates, and
yep.
That's just not not appealing at any level. But when you understand that the people in history were pretty much like we are today, minus a fair amount of technology, but people are still people. And when you read Thomas Paine, when you read Thomas Paine's Common Sense, it speaks over the centuries, and it is clear American thought that was in the 18th century that honestly more people need to read that. Well, you know, we talk about our education program for Revolutionary War Field Days is called Liberty Live. And we use liberty in particular because liberty means something different in the 18th century than we do now. You know, we can say to a school kid, give me what or give me death. And they'll all shout liberty if enough of them know what Patrick Henry said. But then we'll say, what is liberty? And they'll shout freedom. And it's not. It is not freedom. If you go back to John Locke and you look at his writings, liberty in the best sense I know is described as freedom with responsibility. And the idea is, yes, you are free to do what you want to do as long as it doesn't interfere with other people's liberty. So you are not free to go burn someone's store because you're upset about whatever, whether it's a valid thing or not, it doesn't matter. But you don't go burning someone's store down where you don't have a beef with them because you've just infringed on another person's liberty. And I think it's that message of liberty that we have missed out on, and the understanding that liberty is not freedom, but rather liberty is freedom with responsibility. And that comes from John Locke. If you look at his discourse on the American concept of liberty, that's what it's about. You can do things that you want to do as long as it does not harm someone else's life, health, liberty. You don't take your possessions when preservation also comes not in competition. So if you're in competition with someone, you shouldn't drive them into the ground. You can compete, but it should not stress their own liberties. That's my soapbox for the liberty.
It's a good soapbox, Trey. It really is.
Part of it. Trey, thank you for being here tonight.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
Yes, it's been great. And I tell you what, I'm gonna run with this one, Todd. We have 15 minutes left, and that gives each one of our three co-hosts an opportunity to put Trey on the hot seat, on the historical hot seat, and ask him a question. Trey, could you take three? Could you field three questions as we hit the waning moments of this show?
Well, I'm a general surgeon, so I can do everything.
I should have known you were going
to
rise to
the occasion. If I don't know the answer, I can look you straight in the eye and just make something up, and you'll think I'm telling you the straight skin.
Why do you think I like hanging out with this guy, folks?
There you go.
Oh, my goodness. All right, we're gonna flip a coin since we have three, and we're going to go to Tim first.
All right, that works for me. So,
I just said that, and nobody questioned what I just said.
Solid coin. I was wondering what kind of damn coin you're flipping there.
But you didn't say anything. You lose the bet. I was doing a Dr. Trey Donaway. All right, Tim, you first.
I like it. Trying to keep everyone on their toes. I love it. So, you know, one thing that I had thought of is in my past, one of my former jobs, I worked with someone who used to do reenactments, and I was hoping maybe you could just kind of give a little bit more detail to, this is something that you don't think of when you're a spectator, but he mentioned things, you know, like when you're being, and he mentioned, if he says he would lean back and say, hey, I'm going to take a shot here. So to make it realistic, he'd have the guy behind him actually pull him down. But one of the funny things he talked about was like, man, when you're down there, like you're playing dead, you've been shot, you got bugs jumping all around you, and it's hideous. And I was hoping you could maybe elaborate on that or give your kind of experience being actually out there participating in that.
In working with reenactors, they want a couple of things. They're not really demanding. They're wonderful people. This is what they want. They want potable water. They want firewood. And they want straw. Straw for bedding. And also, even in South Carolina in the beginning of November, again, our Revolutionary War Field Days are November 7th and 8th, and we have a special education day this year because of the little change in management. We now can offer a special education day on Friday, November 6th. But as far as the reenactors want, they want those three things, fresh water, straw, and firewood. And they also want one other thing, especially in South Carolina. They want fire ant treatment before they go dead in the field. Because
tell
you what, if you land on a fire ant hill, well, you don't need a resurrectionist because you will come alive. and you will manage to burn to a different part of the battlefield. Maybe you thought you were dead, but not quite. So that's one of the big pet peeves of reenactors. So in this year, I'm happy to report that all of that area, all the area where people will be, is treated with fire ant preventatives. We've got a great location this year with about 24 acres, so tons of room to spread out. COVID has been pestering us. That's a new COVID concern for reenactors, but we've got plenty of room for social distancing. And it is outdoors, so we really have mitigated the COVID crisis pretty well. And we have permission from the Department of Finance of the state of South Carolina to hold our event for up to 5,000 people because we will be employing social distancing strategy. You won't see any tight line formation in the battles. It'll be all at arm's length. It'll still be fine, but it'll be a little bit different this year. The encampments will be spread out a little bit more so we can still have as much safety as possible while not interfering with the 18th century appearance too much. I don't know if I answered your question.
After all those 5,000 people, if they're not at the reenactment, they'll be in Walmart. So, I mean,
that's true. That's exactly right.
I'll save the 2 cents for the night.
Awesome.
All
thank
right,
you for being here.
Look, I got to ask the general surgeon thing. The, velocity rates for rounds, the type of round today is very different than the type of round yesterday. We know there were a lot of amputate, first move, and we still see that today. Could you talk real quick about the trauma to the body between those 75 caliber rounds moving slow and today's 7.62, 215, 223 type rounds, higher velocity, especially the smaller caliber that are designed to split and mess up going in a body, and the different approaches it would take in medical care.
Well, in the 18th century, you were hit by a heavy ball, and if it hit a bone, that bone was going to crack. It's going to cause direct trauma, but very focally. With high velocity rounds, the area of damage extends well beyond the margins of the actual projectile, and that's the biggest difference. That's where if you shoot a watermelon with a high velocity round, you're going to explode the watermelon because of that phenomenal momentum that's primarily due to velocity, not so much mass. But if you shoot the same watermelon with an 18th century gun, you're going to have a lot of mass, but not the velocity. So it won't explode and splinter. You'll just poke a hole in that watermelon. So I think that's probably the basic difference between high velocity rounds. And also the fact that, you know, like you alluded to, if you hit a human with a high velocity with a bullet that splinters, it just creates so much havoc. And your exit wounds are always so much bigger because of that velocity. In the 18th century, your exit wound would be the same size as your entrance wound. There's just not as much kinetic force to a heavier ball going at a slower velocity. Did that answer the question?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to throw it out there because, I mean, those were softer balls. They were, you know, there was they were more variation of a hollow point at the time almost because they were so damn soft versus our things. You know, we got those, we're using different minerals for the projectile.
Yes. You know, I remember Grand Rounds. We had a visiting professor, because I trained in Mobile, Alabama, the University of South Alabama in general surgery. And we had a Grand Rounds where we had some professor coming from Miami, and he gave a talk on ballistics. Of course, Miami, this was during the years of Miami Vice, so, you know, that was a hot topic. And he explained the difference in that NATO and militaries have outlawed tumbling rounds, because it used to be the round would tumble through a body, which would really tear people up. It would put them more than just out of commission. It would create all sorts of internal injuries. And we asked him what his experience was as far as projectiles in Miami, what he dealt with, and he laughed. He said, we talked about the time it took to get the patient in and the timing of surgery, emergency surgery and times, and he goes, well, we actually don't see a lot of gunshot wounds in Miami. We said, really? We thought there was a lot. He goes, well, they usually just don't make it to the hospital. So. Different,
no
different,
injuries.
Different eras, different technology. Again, and today's technology drives today's tactics, and that's the way it was in the 18th century. But I think the primary answer is the you know, your momentum, mass times velocity. Your velocity is a lot higher in modern weapons. It's slower in older weapons, but the ball is a lot heavier, so it could still knock you down, but it wouldn't do as much peripheral damage rather than just the entry wound and the exit.
Amazing how classic physics rules apply today.
Still works. Still works.
Yes, it does.
Dave,
I mean, Todd, those were great questions. We'll give Dave his, and then I guess we'll ride off into the sunset, into the next Revolutionary War battle. Dave, what have you got for Dr. Trey?
I want to ask about the uniforms. Reason being is about 20 minutes up the road from my house here, maybe 25, is Hampstead, North Carolina, where the on Highway 210, you can visit the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge.
Yep, that was early in the war, before the Battle of Sullivan's Island, or before the,
yes,
you know, the battle. Right, exactly.
And what caused the most casualties were the wool uniforms worn by the Scots, and when they fell into the creek, the wool would soak up the water and drown a large portion of the casualties in that battle. So my question is, as a reenactor and as, you know, a historical side of things, to be in South Carolina and dressed in wool had to be just absolute misery.
It had to be, and it still is. So if you want to see the authentic reenactors, they'll have wool uniforms on. But, you know, it'll melt ceramics. It gets so hot in those wool outfits. Linen is a good substitute. And if it's really hot, I'm not putting on my wool outfit. I look like a skirmisher, which is linen, and that's a lot cooler. In the wintertime, it's kind of nice to have the weight, but no, the uniforms, it was, that's why they, you know, people say, why did the Army march at night in August for the Battle of Camden? Well, obviously, you've never been in South Carolina in the middle of August. You're going to go at night because it's cooler, because the Army couldn't go 5 miles without dropping like flies in the daytime, beating down sun on you in a wool uniform. So, yeah, but wool was the official uniform by and large in the services. And it still is. When you look at reenactors' outfits, most of them will still be wool. But I guess the way they look at it is they are reliving history. So if their forefathers and if the people that fought for independence could put up with a wool uniform, if they're going to truly relive history, then they can.
Good stuff.
Wow.
But
amazing.
Anyway,
Trey.
Again, our dates are November 6th, 7th, and 8th. For the public, it's on the 7th and the 8th for the educational program, which, again, is new this year. It's on the 6th, and you can find out more information than you'd ever care to know about if you subscribe to our Facebook channel, which is Rev War Field Days. You can look it up, and the website is revwarfielddays.com.
Hey, we're happy to post it to our page if we get the link.
Oh, sure.
We all have the link.
Todd, I think I'm probably a good one to ask about that because I developed the original version of the site. So I can make sure we got it.
Actually did. And it was just wonderful. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I actually had to get one plug in there for me because Trey's done so many great things.
I called up John on short notice, and I said, John, I got these reenactors that want to create their own independent unit. I need a website. John says, got you covered. No problems. 24 hours later, bingo, there we are.
We had something up, and then it got better. But
just great.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to work with you and your folks, and it's always a pleasure to work with my folks. As crazy as they are, they're the best in the world. So, and Granny Hulkster, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Good.
Yes, I am.
Good. Thank you for being with us, and I'm glad you were able
You're
to
welcome.
Save the gold. You and your kids saved the gold and no reactors
yeah,
in Arkansas.
I like it.
And there's the British lady saying, we have 90 seconds left. So on behalf of everybody here at Pop Culture Stars and with all great will directed to Rev War Field Days, we look forward to November 6th, 7th, and 8th. I will be out there hopefully with a very, very interesting friend of mine. We're working on that. So thanks a lot, Trey. It was a pleasure having you here, hosts and guests. It was wonderful having you here. We'll be back next week. Yes, British lady. We'll be back with another crazy show, and it's always a lot of fun. So I will do the quick call around to everybody, and thank you for being with us. So on behalf of everybody here at Pop Culture Stars, we will see you with a new episode next week at this very time whenever you're listening. Thanks a lot. Take care, and we'll see you soon. Cheers.
Big hugs, everyone. Take care of
yourself. Good night, everybody.
Take care of your family.
Enjoyed it.
And take care of each other.
Good night. Bye.